Ayla, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, I said this to a researcher a few years ago. And I mean, this is someone who works at a think tank. This is like a someone who works with large sets of data. And I was kind of half joking, but talking about the distribution of people around the political compass. And I was like, yeah, it's very few people get this authoritarian left. And he was like, yeah, because that shit is fake. Like that doesn't exist.
What do you mean fake?
Like
there's no people on it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like it's no fake because it's rare.
Well, what people say about the political compass test, like using this, the guy who founded it, David Nolan, became one of the founders of the Libertarian Party. So it skews everyone's results towards that right libertarian quadrant. And that was part of the like design of the quiz. So if you were someone who was like politically curious and you take the quiz, it's not going to tell you that you were like a Soviet communist, for example, because it's trying to tilt people in a certain direction.
Does everybody use the same test? I thought there were a whole bunch of different political compass
tests. There's a whole
tests,
bunch, yeah, but there's like the famous original one.
Okay.
The world's
and
smallest
the original
political
one is bad.
Quiz. Yeah. No, it's not that it's bad. It's just like everything has its own kind of ideological perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Where do fetishes come from?
It's a giant question. That's a huge question that nobody knows the answer to, not even me. And if anybody tells you that they know where they come from, they're probably lying. And it probably depends on the fetish. My guess is different fetishes have different types of origin. And my guess is it's more innate or random than most people think. A lot of people have superstition around the origin of fetishes. So like, oh, well, I had this happen to me as a child or my first girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. And I think in general, they're just sort of post-rationalizing the thing. Like the correlation, or like you look for patterns in your past to tell a story that makes sense to you. But in reality, maybe you're already predisposed to that. And then like exposure to the stimuli was the first trigger. I think in general, it's like more in that direction, but it's not 100%. Like, for example, when I asked people, were you spanked in childhood? And then do you have a spanking fetish? It was like roughly double. So you're roughly double as likely to have a spanking fetish if you're spanked in childhood. And that's like a little hard to explain, right? If it's genetic, it would be a little bit weird for parents with a spanking fetish to be more likely to spank their kids. I don't think it quite works like that. At least I hope not.
So there's a temptation to self-narrativize?
Yes. I think the self-narrativizing is overblown, but there's still some truth in it. Like, it's probably true that you could say my parent spanked me and this probably led to my spanking fetish or something.
Right,
but
right.
It's probably not as true as most people think. Like, most people who are spanked don't have spanking fetishes. But it's also kind of weird because, like, I'm reading Psychopathia Sexualis right now, which is a book on fetishes written in, like, the late 1800s.
Right, right.
And it's really cool to see the different frameworks that they use for categorizing fetishes. Like, they consider a lot of power dynamics to be like sadism or something, and sadism masochism isn't exactly about pain. But that's besides the point. My point is that they have a lot of fetishes this guy describes. He's like, obviously the glove fetishists, you know, all of the men the who are deeply aroused by gloves and will masturbate into gloves, you know. This is a classic category much as it is the foot fetish. And it's very funny because we don't really have a concept of glove fetishes
like
today.
Really...
Right. So obviously there is something where like exposure to a stimuli creates a fetish. So
yeah,
you can't really get around that. But my guess, my theory about how fetishes work is that you have some kind of predisposition, and then the way that manifests depends on your environment.
Mm-hmm.
So like a classic example I like to give is like, imagine you are aroused by like accidental showing of skin. And that might look very different if you were raised in like a conservative Muslim culture versus a very liberal Western culture. Like one of them would be aroused by like the buttocks being flashed, and the other might be like an ankle or wrist. And so like the predisposition is there. There's some interest in the surprise or something, but the symbolism of that becomes really constrained by the culture. This is my theory, but I have no idea what's going on. This is just a theory. But I did a survey where I asked people, like, imagine somebody else was like in a situation where they had to watch a bunch of porn of this type of fetish, how likely is it that you think that they would end up becoming aroused or like acquiring that fetish? And then I asked a separate group of people, if this happened to you, how likely do you think you would be to be aroused by this fetish? And in general, people were much less likely to say that they themselves would, but I think other people would be influenced by things, but not me. Right. And so like, instead of thinking about the way other people have with fetishes, imagine something that you're not aroused by. And then be like, could I get aroused by that if I really tried? And most people generally can't. But I think there's like a variance again in like dispositions to sexuality at all. There's a lot of things to say here, but like when I interview people about fetishes, I'll often try and develop a framework about how fetishes work. I'm like, oh, if you're aroused by, you know, the shininess of shoes, like it must be shininess. And at what is shininess emotionally like resonate with you or something? I'm like looking for some kind of pattern. And I just have never been able to find a pattern. There's just people who have radically different approaches to fetishes in every aspect I could think of. And I would not be shocked if, like, some people have just the mental state where they are much more prone to being influenced sexually by things they see, and other people just aren't at all. Yeah. Are you asking me my ethical system?
Yeah, yeah. How do you determine ethical activity?
I don't know. And I can't tell if I just don't believe in morality or if I'm trying to avoid looking stupid. It feels like I just don't believe in morality. But often when you make a moral claim, you can just substitute out that word for something else, and then it's fine, and you lose very little.
What would you substitute?
Like, you shouldn't kill. Well, you could instead be like, well, if you kill, people can't trust each other. Everybody feels very sad. And I don't like it when people feel sad. So I'm going to stop you, right? Like, ultimately, is this not what things boil down to? You have some sort of sense of aversion. You have, and then you make actions based off of this. If you're asking, like, what are the kinds of senses of aversion I have, I don't have a lot of senses of aversion, but I do like things that are generally pro-social and cooperative. It seems like it makes my life better, ultimately. I don't know if this makes sense as an answer.
Oh, there's no wrong answer. There's no wrong answer.
Well, but there are no nonsensical answers. It's possible.
I mean, there's a lot of them. Yeah. I mean, the work that I used to do before this podcast, I would talk to people from like all over the political spectrum. And the answers you get to that question are fucking wild. Mm-hmm. Have you ever come across The Sensory Order by Friedrich Hayek?
No.
There's some libertarian philosophy that gets very almost metaphysical, I want to say, is involved with like cybernetics, but is basically an early kind of libertarian theory of consciousness. Mm-hmm. But it's strange because I don't really hear people cite that book so often. It's kind of like some of his lesser known work.
Why would a theory of consciousness be libertarian? I don't understand why it's politically.
Friedrich Hayek is a member of the Mont Pelerin Society, the kind of origin of neoliberalism. Today we would describe that as being libertarian, but you would describe it as liberal back in 1947.
You just mean that it was written by somebody who was of this and not that the consciousness itself is a libertarian argument.
Right,
okay,
right.
That makes...
And so people who like his work for the libertarian economic arguments will also be sympathetic to his idea of like the sensory order and sensing. And there's some kind of analogy that people draw with like the dynamism of sensory inputs and price mechanisms and the kind of irreducible complexities of the world and markets. But it gets super abstract and like kind of into cybernetic word salad at a certain point. Mm-hmm. But I'm just kind of curious if that comes up in the communities that you're adjacent to.
I don't. So one, I'm not very well educated. I do the school thing. So maybe it does, and I'm not really aware of it, or they say the name and it passes by me. But I don't think so. I think a lot of people focus on current arguments. There's not as much as an emphasis on studying past works as I think there is in typical academia, which I endorse. I think that generally the studying of past works is stupid. In the way that most people do it. It's not inherently stupid. Like, I'm reading an old book right now about...
What are you reading now?
The Psychopathia Sexualis and the 1800s fetish. And that's interesting, but it's not interesting for what he has to say. It's interesting because you can see how humanity changes, but...
I was a teenage boy once and certainly had friends. We would send each other images that were just the most grotesque, shocking, like... Nothing that anyone wanted to see, but it would be hidden in a link or something like that. And you'd be like, ah, you fucking got me with this shit again.
Like Goatsy?
Yeah, stuff like that, yeah. Which, if it exists, it gets passed around inevitably. It's like you can't, anti-fragile.
Well, one is we are assuming a culture where people do this sort of thing. That would never have happened in my culture, for example, even if you had access to it. So these are cultural norms, but yeah. I watched a lot of shocking stuff voluntarily.
I think now as an adult, like the level of stuff that started to get posted was like really wild. Like it wasn't just extreme pornography that I grew up with as a kid that was just part of being on the internet, period. Then it was like execution videos. It was like ISIS beheadings and shit like that. And I don't know, it made me think like, I didn't need to see some of that shit, you know? Like, and if that keeps getting worse, do I want to raise a kid in a society where they have immediate, instantaneous access to that stuff?
Yeah, I don't know about being exposed to stuff that you don't want to be exposed to. That does sound like a violation of consent. But it sounds less like an issue of the content and more the issue of people trying to expose you to things without your consent. I like would disagree with this, whether it's a parent or whatever, but I would support your right to go look at that if you wanted to. So I don't know. This feels like less an issue of the content itself.
I think it's an inevitability of just the pressures of society that people will act in an antisocial way.
This is true. Yeah.
Like being punk, upsetting people.
Right, but I don't think being like, well, kids aren't allowed to watch this ever is the right move here. I could see maybe something like, again, I'm pro-regulation that increases transparency. At the beginning of a terrifying video, you put like a flash being like, alert. this is a video in which an execution happens.
Sure, sure.
That way you wouldn't be exposed to it accidentally.
Yeah.
I don't know how hard it would be to enforce, though.
On this topic of regulation, the role of the state, what in your mind is the role of government beyond enforcing contracts?
Like protecting from outsiders, maybe? Mm.
What does that mean in this context?
I mean, you know, people try and kill you and it's like much easier to not be killed if you have a coordinated defense. And it's like pretty hard to coordinate a defense on a local level. I don't know. I think this is in general a hard problem.
Police, you mean?
Yeah, or like war people.
Military.
The soldiers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The people with the guns. I think probably this is necessary until we figure out to be more pro-social on like a global level. I have some, but yeah, I don't. I like stuff that comes down to like prediction markets and insurance, and like maybe the government could enforce some of this. But in general, I prefer it for enforcement of like the minimal possible law. I also like land value tax. That's
Georgism.
Yeah, I like that. I don't know.
I'm just curious of how deep down the libertarian spectrum you are, because there's kind of a whole gradation of people who are like ANCAPs and that, you know, the roads shouldn't exist, for example.
I mean, I'm pro private roads. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they can exist, yes, but do you want the state to be the enforcer of contracts? Like, for example, yeah.
I think I'm okay with the state being the enforcer of contracts, but I have not thought very deeply about political philosophy.
Well, in the police answer, it's kind of covered, because if you don't believe in the government as the enforcer of contracts, then you necessarily have to entertain having private security, mm-hmm. which is like, oh, now we've got warlords, and it's kind of a whole runaway problem. The group I started writing about in the very beginning, I published this book in 2018 called Politigram and the Post-Left. Mm-hmm. Politigram is a portmanteau of political Instagram. So it's like teenagers shitposting all different types of political ideology. My favorite were the anarcho-capitalists. Like, they were just the fucking funniest kids. And in particular, this one 12-year-old who is like just, he's still out there posting. It's been like 8 years. It's just, he's so good. There was this, you know, anti-hierarchical, like they were anarchists, treat everybody as individuals. They would say edgy, inflammatory shit, but they were like, you know, pro-individualism, not actually racist. And then people would kind of sneak in who held these beliefs, that they would kind of use the freedom of speech and those provocations to conceal what they really felt. And so some interesting wedges start to open up. And I think it was a failure on behalf of those, like, the radical libertarians, the ANCAPs, of actually, like, ironically, policing their own community. ANCAPs don't really like police, but there wasn't a sufficient moderation mechanism. And then those people were able to kind of set up shop and gain a lot of influence. Like, not just posting memes, but, like, find their way into political organizations.
Yeah.
And so some of the wedges that started to open up, most people do not go this deep. I think we'll probably put this behind the paywall for the episode. But one of the things that I learned following these communities and chasing that rabbit hole all the way down was that I was used to, in the environment I was brought up in, of these kind of white supremacist arguments that white people are smarter than black people, like the kind of bell curve type shit. And then the problem is that, like, if you look at that data, it's like, well, white people are kind of in the middle, and actually there's a whole bunch of people who are a lot smarter. And the ANCAPs, who are actually libertarians, follow that through to its logical conclusion. And they would make arguments for morphological freedom and transhumanism and all these other types of things. But then the guys who were libertarians for now, because they wanted free speech to say racist shit, they had to then entertain a metaphysical concept of race, where they had to kind of basically create a new like myth structure and then move materials in the world to make that thing happen. But they couldn't hold this kind of like scientific empiricism as the basis of their argument. So they had to like invent certain like mythologies or make arguments through culture and through art and through architecture and stuff like this, because they couldn't just hold up a spreadsheet and be like, well, look, you know, these Southeast Asians, just ignore the far column over there, like white people are at the top of this thing. And it actually became like a really interesting dispute, because the far right movements that exist now, they make entirely different arguments that are not familiar to people who grew up in our generation, that are used to the white supremacy on the basis of biological difference. They're making different types of arguments for like... Hi, everybody. This is Joshua Citarella. What you just heard is an excerpt from this week's bonus episode. If you want to hear more and get access to the full catalog for Doomscroll and other podcasts, you can support the show on Patreon or Substack, where I'm putting out new episodes every week. This is an independent show. I don't do any advertising, so your support is really what keeps this project going. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.